Okay, without further ado, Daniel, you're on.
Okay, and Rick, I'm on.
Amazing.
And you're up.
And I'm up.
Okay, I promised a little bit about me, so here's a quick thumbnail. I knew by the time I went to kindergarten that I was going to be an engineer and a musician. And that all came true. And as far as the career path thing is concerned, I figured out at a very early age that there is a straight linear path from where you are and what your goal is. But as you're going along, you're always going to be tempted to branch off. Don't branch off. Just stay on it and you'll get there. Okay? So I got into this whole electronics thing at a very early age. By the time I was not even in junior high school yet, I was already building radios and things like that. But I wanted to follow the time-honored tradition to always tell a joke when you start off, but this is actually a true story. I don't remember exactly how old I was. I think it was probably about the fourth grade. I decided that I really wanted to have an electric guitar. So I got a cigar box, and I put a neck on it, and I got some wire, and I did this string, you know, and all that stuff. And it made noise. So I decided, okay, it would be really cool if I could have an electric guitar. So I got the little transformer speed control from my electric train set, and I wired up the terminals to the string on that guitar that I had built. And no matter how fast I turned up the speed control, it never got any louder, which kind of really, it just kind of bummed me out. I couldn't figure that out. Of course, later on when I got into building radios and all that, I did figure it out. And so it just kind of all stemmed from there. Now, we're talking about analog modular synthesizers tonight, but there's a big problem in trying to demonstrate anything like that, which is you can't see it. I actually have an analog synthesizer here. This Moog Little Fatty is actually a completely analog synthesizer that has a computer inside of it, but that's just for things like storing and recalling presets. And it also adds some enhancements like MIDI control and things like that. But you can't really see me pressing the buttons. You can't see me twisting the knobs. You don't really know what I'm doing. You don't know what's going on under the hood. So as a result, a lot of the demonstrations I'm going to be doing for you tonight are actually going to take place inside of a program called Reactor, which is, as far as I've been able to find, the most sophisticated modeling software for playing around with what is essentially modular synthesis. And we'll be able to look at some structures that I've built and talk about what's going on and why. Some of these structures I've included oscilloscopes into so you can actually see the waveforms as well. We did run into one little snag here with the presentation, which means that I'm actually going to be doing a lot of punting tonight. And that is, when I got this laptop, I was really excited about the fact that it could do dual screen. And the idea was, okay, I'm going to do the PowerPoint presentation on one screen. Actually, for Mac, it's called Keynote. And I'll have Reactor on the other screen so I can manipulate the controls, and then if you need to see the structures, I'll just drag them up, right? And all the time I was preparing the presentation, you know, that's exactly what I was doing, building slides in one screen, building structures in the other screen. And then I decided, you know, I should rehearse this and see how easy it is to flow back and forth between the two, and that's when I found the gotcha. If you actually run the demo, not just make the slides and look at them, but if you run the PowerPoint, it blanks out the other screen. So that pretty much just put an end to that. So I'll be working off of my outline tonight, and I did save another screen, which I'm going to put up right now. Oh, that's interesting. There it is. But from this point on, if I actually need to have any kind of a illustration, it'll either be something that you'll see that I pre-built in Reactor, or I've brought along my little pad here. So if you have a question, I can draw on this, and you can have a visual to go along with whatever I'm talking about. I would encourage you all to ask as many questions as you please, as long as they're relevant, and try to get some kind of a dialogue going. I've been teaching for a long time, and I figured at some point, you know, I should probably learn a little bit about teaching. And so what I discovered was, if I sit here and I talk to you, when you walk out the door tonight, you're going to remember 10% of what I said. That's it, just 10%. But if you actually ask me some questions, and we have a little bit of interaction going on back and forth, the amount of information you're going to retain when you walk out the door is going to go up substantially. So I would encourage you all to turn this more into a discussion than just a download.
Just for clarity, can I ask you a question then?
Absolutely.
Did I understand correctly that you, when you're running two applications, you can't view one app on one screen and the other? Was that basically the...
Well, under normal circumstances, you can. But when you're running PowerPoint or Keynote, at some point you have to actually hit the button to play the show.
That's right.
And that is when everything goes south, because... then you either see the presentation on both screens, or if you say only display on one screen, it decides that it would be a really good idea if it just turns the other screen black. So thereby, you know, if you're trying to run any other program at the same time that you have to manipulate, it becomes virtually impossible. So if you'll forgive me for a moment here. I'm not sure what it's going to take. I'm trying to figure out. Oh, I know what's going on. Forgive me. I have to open up my notes. I opened up these screens, but I never actually opened up my presentation notes. There we go. Now, one of the things that I decided as I went through the process of putting this all together was that I wanted to come at this from a completely different perspective than the way that you would normally do it. You walk into a classroom, they start to teach you about synthesis, and the first thing you're going to see is going to be something that's going to be similar to this. And they're going to start getting into the individual modules, and they're going to say, all synthesizers have some kind of a source. This could be an oscillator, this could be noise, this could be an external sound, it could be anything. And you've got to have a starting point, you've got to have at least that. At that point, you could just plug that in and listen to it. Or the next most common thing that would happen is that you'll run it through a filter so that you can modify the spectral content. And then you'll probably run it through the amplifier and then out the door into your sound system. And you'll notice at the bottom we have a box here for control. And with analog modular synthesizers, that control is typically a voltage control system. We'll talk much, much more about that as we go through the night. But sometimes it also includes MIDI. You can have a MIDI system where you can take the MIDI information, you can convert it into a voltage, and then the voltage can talk to the modules. And that can also be a very viable option. I will talk at length about these kinds of issues as we get through the night. And then the next thing that they'll typically do is they'll go into all manner of things that have to do with the sources, like multiple oscillators, syncing oscillators, FM modulation, additive synthesis, subtractive synthesis, and all that stuff, which I will talk about tonight. But these are the kinds of things that you're going to get out of any book. These are the kind of things that you're going to get out of going on the web. So I want to focus a lot on the information that you are not going to get when you go to all the standard sources. A lot of times you want to learn how to make a particular sound, they'll give you a recipe like a cookbook. It'll say, plug this cord in here, take the other end and plug it in over there, and voila, you're going to get sound X. But that doesn't really tell you why you got the sound, and it doesn't really tell you how you're going to get the next sound that you're looking for. One of the things about working with a modular synthesizer is that you have to do absolutely everything to make it work. If you buy a packaged analog synthesizer like this one, all the connections are already made inside. I can twiddle the knobs, I can change all the control parameters, but the minute I hit a key, I'm going to get a sound. With a modular synthesizer, that just isn't going to happen. You have to plug all these modules into each other, and so you have to have some idea of what's going to happen when you do it. Now, one of the nice things about modular synthesizers is that you can just randomly start plugging things in. Chances are excellent, if it's well designed, that you're not going to break anything, and you might be surprised by the results you get, and I would kind of encourage that kind of behavior because it can be interesting. But it's also a good idea to know what's going on under the hood because it'll help you get the sounds you're looking for a lot faster. So we will be coming back to all this sort of thing later on. And now I want to actually kind of move in a completely different direction. So let me kill this slide. We don't really need this anymore. And as it becomes relevant, I will drag stuff over onto this other screen so that you can see it. So, Rick, I'm going to go ahead and bring up the first sound here. Now, I am going somewhere with this. I'm going to try to make a point. So my question to you all is this sound interesting? For how long? You know, not unless you're 420 friendly. So let's see, you know, what we can do to try to kind of make this a little bit more interesting here. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to add some reverb to it just to give it a sense of space. So that's a little better, but you know, that's going to still get pretty monotonous. So the next thing I'm going to do here is I'm actually going to use a low frequency oscillator, and I'll explain what these things are as we go along, to basically turn the signal on and off. Now, because I've got all this reverb, even after I turn the signal off, it's going to kind of hang for a minute. So that's still not terribly interesting, but at least we're starting to get somewhere with it. Now, the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to use another low frequency oscillator to play around with the pitch. Okay, now we're starting to get into movie soundtrack, man. So I'm going to kick in a flanger, and we'll see what happens with that. I started modulating the pitch with an LFO. A flanger. Okay, so now you tell me, would you rather listen to that? Or would you rather listen to this? So the takeaway point from all of this is that if we're going to make the sound interesting, we have to animate the sound. We have to do something with it. And that's really a big part of the whole point of what I'm talking about tonight. So let me get my notes back up here.
Daniel, when you added reverb, mm-hmm. What were the fundamental properties of that reverb?
Okay, we should probably talk about those individual things, although we're going to be going back into that in a little while. I want to make sure I understand your question.
Well, like the RT, you know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, this particular reverb is a guitar pedal. It doesn't have any indicator of any of that sort of thing. Gotcha. It's set for... Oh, shoot, I had it on modulation. Sorry, I meant for it to be in a big hall.
Name of the pedal?
This is TC Electronics. It's called the Hall of Fame. And I like it quite a bit. It's a really clean-sounding little pedal. It's got some great sounds in it.
Like a phase shifter.
Well, I accidentally the knob must have gotten bumped when, in my bag transporting over here. It was supposed to be on a large room.
It's a happy accident.
Yeah, happy accident. So there was a little modulation. I heard that. I was wondering where that was coming from because I didn't.
It wasn't in the script.
Yeah, it wasn't in the script. So there was some delay on that. I had this has a filter on it so that you can turn the treble up and down. I had that wide open, and had some delay on it. So adding reverb really does go a long way towards making a synthesizer sound more interesting, which kind of leads to a good point, which is when you're checking out analog modular or analog modules, a lot of times they can sound really dry. And they won't necessarily have the sound that you expect. You're thinking to yourself, you know, I want a module that sounds fatter than that, or you know, I want something that's got more balls. But in a lot of ways, that stuff comes from how you process it. Some modules obviously sound differently than others, but to get those kinds of tones, a lot of that stuff is actually in the processing. So, one of the things that I was doing here was a process called modulation. So, all these devices have parameters. A parameter is basically just a control point. So, the tone control, the reverb level, the amount of delay time, inside the structure itself, how fast I was turning the sound source on and off. These are all control parameters, and if we're going to vary these parameters, we've really got two possibilities here. We can do it manually. You can actually twist a knob, or another possibility that you have is this device. This is a foot-operated volume control. I can just plug something in and plug it out, and I can turn audio signals up and down. But it also has a jack over here that says EXP. That's an expression pedal. And so some devices, like the synthesizer and this phase shifter, actually have input jacks that take expression pedals. They're a tapering sleeve. And so while I'm playing, I can be turning various parameters up and down with my foot in addition to twisting knobs in real time. The other possibility that we have, which you just heard a moment ago, was that some of these processes can be automated. We can have control signals being generated by another module, and those control signals can then be routed to some particular parameter that we want to mess with. Now, these two ideas are not mutually exclusive. You can and often will use both of them at the same time. Now, when you have manual control, you'll notice that you have the ability to really put a lot of expressiveness into what you're doing. You can play the instrument in the moment, and you can be varying the effect. I mean, a very common example of that would be, how many synthesizer players in the 70s did you ever see that could keep their hand off the pitch wheel or the modulation wheel? You know, by moving these around and changing these parameters, you're able to, you know, put a little bit of life into it, or, you know, twisting knobs while they're playing. So that is definitely a very important part of approaching the instrument, is to not let it be static, to actually play it, not just play the keyboard. But you can only do so much of that. You've only got two hands and 2 feet. So now when we get to the control signals, you've got the ability that you could change virtually every parameter in your system that is controllable. A lot of what you're going to do in your patches is going to depend on this. And so the basic structures, all these patches, all these control signals, that's going to create your basic sound. And then the little bit of knob twisting that you're going to do is going to give you that actual performance expressiveness. And one thing I want to mention also is that these control signals can also be waveforms. So one of the patches that you just heard, and maybe I'll bring this structure up, pull it down so that you can see it. When I say pull it down, it's because I pull down to get things onto the screen. Okay, so let's take a look at what's going on over here. Spin around so I can see what we're doing here. Okay, so this guy right here is an oscillator. It was producing a sawtooth waveform, and that's the basic sound that you heard all by itself. At that point, the flanger was turned off. Now, in order to be able to turn that on and off, I had to add some additional circuitry that you normally wouldn't have to mess around with. But because this is not an analog synthesizer, it has some of its own rules that I have to follow. But for instance, I wanted to have a switch so that I could decide whether or not you were going to hear this effect. So this switch is this guy right here. When it's in the direct mode, then the control signal over here for volume passes through this relay, and that sets the volume of the oscillator. When I put the switch in the other position, then I have a low frequency oscillator here, and there's the frequency control for it. It's putting out a square wave, which is, excuse me?
What frequency do you use for the low frequency oscillation? Like, what's the range? I'm not familiar with
that. Hang on a second here. Let's find out. Some of these have ranges on them and some of them do not. No, unfortunately this one doesn't have a range control, so I really can't tell you. But
you have a frequency knob. You can go through the frequency knob.
I do, but I have no idea how that really relates to anything in the real world. Okay. So
I have a sec.
Over left, top.
Excuse me? Okay. Yeah. Get a frequency counter and put it on there. So so that is producing the basic waveform, which is telling this relay, turn on, turn off, turn on, turn off. Now, with a low frequency oscillator, it's essentially absolutely the same as any other oscillator. It's just designed to be operated at much lower frequencies than the ones that you would listen to if you want to hear pitch. However, some low frequency oscillators do have the ability to get all the way up into the audio range. Case in point, this little Moog phase shifter here, I didn't just bring it along because I wanted to have a phase shifter. There's a low frequency oscillator built into it, and the guys at Moog are forward thinking guys, and so they gave you all the tap points for this thing. So I can grab the oscillator out of here, and I'm going to do this later tonight, and I can patch it over to the input on this synthesizer, and I can use that LFO to modulate the synthesizer. Anyways, in this particular case, you can see this is the shape of a square wave, but a square wave doesn't actually have to be that exact shape. You'll notice that the on is exactly the same as the off. That's called the pulse width. But if we mess around with that pulse width so that it's on longer or on less, will have a drastic effect on the harmonic content that it's putting out. And in this particular case, because I'm using it to set the timing for this relay, if I make that pulse narrower, it isn't going to be on and off the same amount of time. It's going to be, instead of being on, off, on, off, it's going to be on, on, on. You see what I'm saying? And there's a whole branch of synthesis that you can do that's just based on the idea that you're changing the ratio of the on time to the off time. Anybody here remember the old Commodore 64 computers? Okay, they used to have some programs in there that would synthesize human speech. And all of that speech synthesis was being done
with pulse width modulation. They were just modulating how wide that pulse width was at any given moment. So it can be a very powerful tool. And like I said, it can be used either for changing the harmonic content, or it can be used, you know, for timing, which is how I'm using it here. Now, in this next part of the structure, I have another low-frequency oscillator, but this time I'm taking a sine wave out of it, and you can see the sine wave here. And that's going through another switch so that we can either have it active or not. And then over here, I'm setting a steady pitch, so we'll always hear that particular pitch as the bass pitch. And what the oscillator is doing is it's, as it goes through its cycle, it's raising and lowering the pitch just a little bit. Actually, the way I have it set up, it's just raising it and bringing it back down, raising it and bringing it back down. Now, when you do this at slow speeds, you get something called vibrato. And that's kind of what's happening here. And then, of course, we get over to the phase shifter and flanger, and I'm using it in the flanger mode, and that's all of these controls up here. We're actually going to get into a lot more about this later on in the presentation when I talk about time-based effects.
A flanger and, specifically?
Excuse me?
In terms of how a flanger behaves?
How the basic underlying circuitry works. So a flanger and a phase shifter is pretty much the same. In fact, a chorus, a phase shifter, and a flanger can all be made from exactly the same circuit. It just depends on how you wire them up. But most of us are used to using phase shifters that actually use a different kind of a circuit. Since we're on the topic, I'll go ahead and answer that one now. But
I'm not familiar with a flanger. That's why I was kind of just puzzled. What is mm-hmm. this thing that he's talking about?
Well, what's happening in a phase shifter is you typically have a circuit that has a series of capacitors that you're running the audio through, and each one of those capacitors is going to have a slight shift, is going to cause a slight shifting in the phase. And then you have some kind of a control circuit that is increasing or decreasing that amount of phase shift. So it's all basically done with transistors and capacitors. But at a certain point, we came up with a chip called the Analog Bucket Brigade, which I'll talk more about tonight. And that allowed us to actually create some delay time as the audio passed through the chip. And if we take that and we compare it back to the original circuit and then we mess around with the delay time, it basically causes pretty much the same effect. So, but like I said, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself because I'm already starting to use all kinds of undefined terms here. Okay, so let's see if there's anything else. If I open up this structure, then you can see what's going on inside of this, but it's just a rabbit's nest. We just keep digging deeper and deeper and deeper down into the thing, and I'd rather not go there right now. Okay, so let me pull this out of the way.
What's that instrument called, the reactor?
Oh, it doesn't exist. I made it specifically for tonight. And I call it AES Basic Sawtooth Demo.
So what does reactor do? I mean, what's its purpose in life normally?
Oh, that's a good story. I should tell that one. There's a show that happens in Anaheim every year called NAMM, which is the show that all the music stores and manufacturers go to see all the new toys. And it's hall after hall after hall after hall. It takes a while to walk from one end to the other. And then you get to the very back, and then you go down into the basement. And the guys in the basement are the new guys. You know, they haven't got the seniority or the money to be able to move up into the upstairs area. So typically, you find all the cool stuff, you know, all the new emerging stuff down in the basement. So years and years and years ago, I go down into the basement, and I see these two German guys. And their whole booth was smaller than what I have sitting here in front of me right now. They didn't have this. I'm not sure their table was even as wide as this one. I mean, literally, there was two stools and a table that was about maybe this wide and a laptop, and that was it. And they had this program they had written called Reactor, which was a simulation of a modular synthesizer. But the cool thing about it was that a lot of the other ones that have come on the market since, they basically give you the entire package. You just see a picture of a module, and you see a picture of a jack, and you put a virtual patch cord into it, and then you plug that virtual patch cord in somewhere else. And it's just like having, from a functional point of view, like having a real analog modular synthesizer. But what that means is that whatever modules they wrote, that's what you get, period. And what the guys who wrote Reactor had done was they took a different approach, and they said, we're going to write all these tiny little bits and pieces of code, and we're going to encapsulate them into these little boxes. And you can then take those little boxes and you can wire them up. And then you can start building structures out of that, and then you can wire those structures together. And then you can take that and you can wire that with other stuff that you do. So by the time we've gotten now to version 5 of this program, they've got this almost all the way down to the code, where you can actually go really, really, really deep and pretty much build up anything that you can think of. There's a couple things in here that I haven't found yet, but I strongly suspect that if I had the initiative, I could probably create it from scratch based off of these tiny little core modules that they've added in.
Do they expose a code interface for you so you can write something?
No, that's the one thing that you don't get to do. And I have a strong suspicion that there's a reason for that. If you want to get into that kind of thing, I would probably say the cheapest and fastest way to go there is to start playing around with C sound.
What Everybody, about SynthMaker?
What's that?
SynthMaker.
I haven't seen that one yet.
It'll do both the code and assembly.
Mm-hmm. Just for those of you who don't know, there's been a program around for years. It's free. You can go online and download it. It runs on Linux. It runs on Mac. It runs on PC. And it's called C Sound, and you basically write the whole program in C or C++ or something like that and compile it, and then you run it. And so, you know, whatever you are clever enough to think up in your code, that's what it's going to do.
I think it's an open source project.
Yeah, it's exactly. It originally came out in Linux, so it was all open source, and then over time, people started porting it over to Macs and porting it over to PCs. It's been around forever. And once again, completely free, and if you go on their website, you can download manuals, and there's a huge community of people that do this. And then there's Cycling 64 out of San Francisco, so if anybody wants to get serious about doing their own code, I mean, you can go there if you want to. But I can tell you that it's dangerous to do that. You know, I'll give you a good example. My head has been in this program pretty deep for a while here, trying to get everything ready for tonight. And finally this morning, I was in the shower, and I was thinking about this particular circuit that I wanted to try to figure out some way of creating for you guys so that you could see how it would work. And about halfway through the shower, I realized that I had absolutely no idea what I was doing at that moment. I couldn't remember if I washed my hair yet. You know, I vaguely had this memory of soap on my body, but I wasn't sure. So I had to basically just start all over again, and that's what this stuff will do to you, you know. So you've been warned. Okay, so we're rapidly burning time here, so let's keep moving. So a basic review of electronics, and the way that I'm going to do this is I'm going to try to keep tying it back into the relevancy of what we're talking about. For those of you that are electrical engineers, shut up. This is intentionally dumbed down because we're trying to keep it on topic. So, I probably should have done a graphic for this, but oh well.
You can draw here.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Oh, you know what? Hang on a second. There is a moderate amount of grief that's involved in this process. the clever folks in Macland decided that even though they have a paint program, they're not going to give it to you anymore, nor will they sell it to you anymore if you buy a new computer. So I had to go into the Mac store and find a paint program, and this one's got a little fussiness to it. If I don't open it exactly right, it has a fit. Oh, good. It decided that it's happy. All right, so time to get out the pen. So, electronic circuit. You basically have a positive and a negative. Well, it's not drawing. What happened?
The focus moved away probably when you get the mouse.
Oh, hang on a second. I know what happened. That's kind of odd. There we go. Somehow I hit something that took away my tools. There we go. All right, so in electronic circuits, you'll have a positive terminal and you'll have a negative terminal. And from there, you'll have wires that go out to something. Oops. It is interesting trying to do this when you're looking backwards.
It's hooked to an antenna.
Apparently. It's hooked up to, that's two diodes back to back.
Okay.
EE joke there. So the basic idea here is that you're going to have energy flowing between these terminals. And I'm choosing my words very carefully here. The most basic circuit that you're going to have is what's called direct current. And the typical way of teaching direct current is that the energy flows from the positive terminal through the device and back to the negative terminal. And then you get a little bit further in college and they teach you, well, actually what's happening is that the energy is flowing from the negative terminal to the positive terminal. And then you finish up that semester and you take the next class and they tell you the truth, which is that energy is actually flowing in both directions at the same time. Positive energy is flowing in one direction and hole charges. You should have taken my other class. And the electrons are flowing in the opposite direction. Okay, but the key thing here is that this is a constant, steady movement. This charge is always flowing this way, and this charge is always flowing that way. Now, when we get to AC, alternating current, that doesn't happen. In fact, what's happening there is that we're flowing in one way, then we flow the other way. Then we flow this way, then we flow back and forth and back and forth. Okay? Now, direct current, good example of that is a battery and all the little widgets that power all the stuff I'm playing with here. What you have coming out of the wall is alternating current. The main reason for that being is that we can transmit alternating current a hell of a lot farther than we can direct current. And then we have one other thing that is going to be highly relevant to what we'll be talking about for the rest of the night. And that is fluctuating DC. Now, if you were to see alternating current coming out of the wall, it would look like that. And if you were going to see DC, it would just be steady at some voltage. But here, in this alternating current, like I said, even though the waveform is rising in magnitude and then lowering and then coming back up again over and over and over again, in the AC, it's actually going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, whereas in the direct current, it's just always flowing. In fluctuating DC, which is what you're going to encounter virtually inside of all of this stuff, this DC is increasing and decreasing over time. So if it goes high and then stays there for a while and comes back down again, or if it does this, or if it does this, or even if it does this, it's still DC. DC does not have to be a steady voltage. The only thing that qualifies it as DC is the fact that the electrons are still only flowing in one direction. Now, this is why they don't teach you this until after you've had the other two parts, because it takes a while to wrap your head around all of this stuff.
How would you make an 8-bit wave, a bit wave, instead of like a saw or a sine wave?
Lots of different ways to do that. Lots of different ways. Now, you specifically said 8-bit.
Or a bit wave, yeah.
If I understand correctly, because I'm not sure of the term that you're using, but it sounds to me like you're talking about something that involves turning something on and off and then varying the pulse width. I think what you're referring to is another way of saying some kind of pulse width modulation. Now, there is something else that you might be thinking about here. I'm going to throw this term out to you, and you can try to remember it. Continuously variable slope delta modulation. Look that up on Wiki, and then look up sigma delta modulation, and you'll pretty much know exactly how all modern analog to digital converters work, because those systems operate off the idea of a one-bit system rather than having some huge amount of bits on the input, or excuse me, on the output of the converter. But as I said before, you can, you know, by toggling states, a state is basically what is the condition of the voltage. Is it sitting at ground, or is it sitting at a higher level? On, off, plus, minus, one, zero, all ways of saying the same thing. That's the state that this is in. Let me get my eraser and get rid of all this stuff. Oh, wait a second, what am I doing? I just bought this program. I don't know what I'm thinking. There is a faster way to get there from here. There we go. Okay. That must be dirt on something. That's not me.
You forgot a spot in the shower this morning.
Apparently. I wouldn't be surprised. All right, so a long time I read in a book that there was only two things that you could do with electricity. You could turn it on and off, or you could change how much you've got. I then realized that, in fact, the book was wrong. There are three things that you can do with electricity. And I'm going to talk about all three, and as we go through all three, I'm going to try to bring in the relevancy of each one of these things. The first thing that you can do with electricity is you can convert it to some other form of energy, or you can convert some other form of energy to electricity. This is especially relevant for what we're doing because there's ways that you can leverage this in the music. So, some examples here. Heat. You can use electricity to make heat. Heat can make electricity. Light. Same story. Acoustical energy. All right? I'm talking. That's being converted into electricity. And then it's going through all this system and coming out of these speakers and being turned back into acoustical energy again. So, that's pretty mandatory if you're going to do that. But think about this a little bit further. We can a speaker is a transducer, but there are other kinds of transducers. Heat sensors, light sensors, wind sensors, accelerometers. Virtually anything that you can measure that's going to have some kind of an output, you can take that output, turn it into a control voltage, and then you can run that control voltage into one of your synthesizer modules. So, for instance, if you wanted to set up a little weather station in your house and you patched it all together to make different kinds of sounds, you would basically have an electronic wind chime that by whatever sound it was making, you would know just from that one unique sound what the humidity was, what the barometric pressure was, what the temperature was, and what the wind speed was, because it would only ever make that one sound when all of those conditions were exactly a certain way. And if the wind started blowing a little harder or the temperature got a little warmer, now that sound is going to change. Okay? And I think that kind of talk goes into what we were talking about earlier when you said that, you know, how do you use this in your sound design? So when I said the circuit is the sound, I want you guys to take that in the absolute most literal way possible. The sound that you hear and the circuit that you use to create it are virtually the same thing. Make any change in that circuit, and now you don't have that sound anymore. Okay, so.
Have you gotten to the third thing yet? You said on-off and change the amount.
Well, we're talking about on-off right now.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
All right.
Well, actually, we were just talking about converting to and from.
Yeah, right.
Now we're going to talk about turning it on and off. Okay, so the most basic thing that you have available to you to turn electricity on and off is a switch. And I got switches all over the place here that I can turn things on and off with. But it requires manual intervention for me to do that. So if I could come up with an electronic switch, now I can have ways to have the system do things on its own that I don't have to be directly involved in. And I can also make this circuit more sophisticated, so now it can start to make some decisions and it can actually become a partner with me in the process of making music. So logic circuits are what we use for this. That's the backbone of everything that you find inside of computers. And we already talked before about if the voltage is high, it's an on state or a digital one. If the voltage is low, it's a zero or it's off. The most basic one that we have is called an inverter. If you put a signal into it, whatever you put in, you get the opposite out the other end. So if I hit it with a one, a zero comes out the other end. Hit it with a zero, I get a one. This immediately starts to present a problem for us if we're using it in a musical application and also for a lot of engineering applications as well. Because what if you're dealing with something that isn't pure logic? You're trying to interface music to a logic circuit. Well, you might find that those levels that it's expecting to see are so clearly defined that your signal might be kind of jittery, kind of going above and below that threshold of where it's going to decide to go from one state to the other. So we can clean this up very easily. And by the way, different kinds of logic have different thresholds. If you're working with CMOS, it's a half of the power supply. So if the power supply is 5 volts, it says 2.5 volts, man. If it's higher than that, I'm on. If it's lower than that, I'm off. And if your signal's doing that, it's going to be doing this. Okay, it's going to be just flipping on and off. So what we can do is we can actually create a dead band between where it'll turn on and off. And so now it has a little bit of a range in there where if your signal's kind of flickering around, it's not going to be false triggering on the logic. And this is called a Schmidt trigger. So when you're looking at logic circuits and when you're buying modules, if they have logic circuits included in them, especially on the input stage, you can ask whether or not that input stage is a Schmidt trigger, because if it is, then you've got this a little bit extra immunity to little variations in your signal or noise or anything like that. Okay, so the next thing that we have is an OR gate, and for this I'm actually going to bring reactor back up because I built a demo for this. Hold on a second. That's not it. Let me try a different one. I'm having a little problem here where I'm still getting used to Macintoshes. There we go, now I can see the entire file extension. Here we go. All right, let me drag this down where you can see it. Hopefully you'll be able to. Yeah, I think that's pretty easy to see.
Are you creating just these patches or the actual instrument right there?
What you're seeing here would not really make any sound that you would want to listen to, and I'm going to prove it right now. You ready, Rick?
Yeah.
Now, the reason why the noise is there is because I wanted to show you that I'm using logic circuits to turn audio on and off. But you've also got some visual indicators here that'll show you what the state of the logic is at any given time. So all I've done right now is I've turned it on and off. And that's just a basic switch. Okay. Now, this is an inverter. So whatever I tell it to do, it's going to do the opposite. So I'm going to turn it on, and then I'm going to activate the circuit, and you hear nothing. Since I'm sending it a 1, it's giving me a 0. And down here in the structure, what's happening is that when I have that particular logic circuit engaged, all these logic circuits are coming over to this relay. The noise is going into the relay and out to this little mixer that you see over here, and then all the rest of this stuff is just these visual indicators. The real action here is on this control line. That turns the relay on and off, which means that these logic circuits have to be in the right state to produce an output. So as soon as I turn the inverter off, now you hear the sound because I sent it a 0, so it's outputting a 1. Now, one thing I want to mention is that all the rest of these logic gates that you can see, they're available in two forms. They're available as the basic logic package itself, but you can also get it with the inverter built into it so that you can then have all those logic functions, but you can have the opposite of the result come out the other end if that's what you want. So this is an OR gate, and the way that an OR gate works is it has two or more inputs, and if either one of them is positive, or a 1, or if both of them are, something's going to come out the other end. Now, why would we want to use this in an audio circuit, or in a control circuit for audio? You might have a situation where you have multiple processes that could be occurring. And if any one of them does actually turn on, you might want it to then have some way of routing its audio through the system. This next example here is kind of an interesting variation on the theme. This is also an OR gate, one input or the other. Sorry. Here we go. So if I turn on one input or the other, same thing happens, but this is called an exclusive OR. It turns out that if you turn them both on at the same time, you get nothing. So now you've got a condition that's different. Here, if either one of these is high or if both of them are high, you'll get an output. But here, if both of them are high, you will get no output. So this is a way of blocking a signal. Let's say I've got something going on in my patches over here and something going on in my patches over here. And if both of those are on at the same time, I don't ever want something else to make it through the chain. I can throw in one of these exclusive OR gates here, and I can use that to do that function. And then the last one we're going to have here is an AND gate. This one only becomes active if both of the inputs are on. And one of the ways that you might use an AND gate is you could put an on and off switch on one terminal, and then your logic signal could be on the other terminal, and then you could have a manual way of turning the logic system on and off. You could also have situations where you've got various things going on and you will only get a certain sound to happen if both of these processes are running at the same time. Any questions on anything that we've talked about so far? Go ahead.
Yeah,
So how do you change the waveform right there?
In this particular case, are you referring to the actual sound that we're hearing?
Yeah, and where do you even get that waveform in reactor?
Okay, well, this is a noise source, and this particular module is only capable of creating noise. However, if I want to hear something else, I just plug it into a different module. So I could plug it into a sine wave oscillator or a triangle oscillator or a sawtooth oscillator.
That's what I'm saying, is where do you drag that? Those oscillators.
Where's the toolbox?
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not in edit mode, but give me a moment here so that I...
And is there a way you can automate this stuff when it's a plug-in?
It will work as a VST plug-in if you want it to.
But, I mean, can you automate while it's a plug-in?
Yes.
To the MIDI?
Yeah. Yeah, there's full MIDI control for all this stuff. Hang on a second. Oh, sorry. I am in edit mode. So
I'm not sure if in MIDI mode you can actually change the configurations.
No, you can't. You can't do that, but you can change the parameters, yes.
Right.
Okay, so when you're in the edit mode, you basically just right-click inside of the environment, and then now you have access to all the different kinds of functions that's capable of. The most lowest level that you can do is the core cells. Then from there you go to modules, then you go to macros, then you go to instruments.
Can you show us like the oscillator one? Or just
we'll see that as we go through the night. I want to try not to drift too far off topic because I'm only using this as a tool to demonstrate modular synthesis. I don't really want to do a lecture on reactor. Any other questions? There's a lot of times when that might come up.
Can I say something?
Sure.
In the refrigerator, you've got a switch that when you push it, the light goes off. So there's a practical use of an inverter.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. One of the things that you can also do is... sometimes inverters are used when you're building up more sophisticated logic circuits. Some of the packages that you can actually buy that we're going to talk about later, like flip-flops and things like that, are actually built up out of these core concepts. But one obvious thing would be I have something that the synthesizer is doing, and when it's doing it, I don't want something else to happen. So it's creating a signal. I take that signal and I use it to create an off on the other side. And that off is controlling a relay or a voltage-controlled amplifier or something like that. So the presence of this process being active can shut off the signal flow coming out of this other one. I might not want to power that circuit down for some reason. I might want it to also always be running so that at any given moment I can allow its audio to pass through. But I still have to have some way of automating the process of it being able to be in the stream or not so that I don't actually have to push a button to do it. So... let's move on. So once again, you can add the inverters to any of these functions. And when you do, an OR gate is a NOR gate. You can have a NAND gate or an exclusive NOR. Let me pull up another demo. Because now I want to talk about a little bit more advanced kind of a logic circuit that you probably will end up running into. In fact, one of these I absolutely know you're going to run into this one all the time if you start getting into this. Okay. Now, this demo, we're going to talk about two functions. One of them is the compare function. And this could have a lot of applications. Basically, what's happening is you have a reference signal here that's going into this module.
And then you have some other active signal that you want to compare to it. If this signal, and this could be two active audio streams as well. It doesn't just have to be a reference, it's just that it usually is. If this signal is greater than the other one, then we will output a high state here. Now you notice this particular compare module can do a variety of functions. It'll also make a decision based on if this level is lower than the other one, or if they're equal, and this particular one, I'm not quite sure what that is. I haven't played with this module much. It's probably a not equal. So let's see how that actually affects things in the real world. So here's the, I'm not sure how hot this signal is going to be, Rick. We're not getting any sound. Why is that?
Too bad it doesn't have a little light or LED on the output of each one of those to show you the state.
The funny thing about this program, the one thing that they missed, there are no LEDs in Reactor. You have lights, but those lights only respond to audio signals. So that's you have to do some working around. I know I tested this at home, but we should be hearing something right now. The amplitude is up. No, I didn't put an on and off switch on this one.
Maybe your inverter's still on.
That's possible.
Nah.
Well, the other thing here is that...
how come A is red and B is green?
Oh, that's just because that's the last thing that was activated.
Oh.
Will it output in edit mode?
Well, see, here's the deal. You
on the dials, A and B are the same, but you're connected to greater than. Don't you need to make A greater than B?
Yes. But there's still nothing. Oh, that's too bad. Well, I did have this working at home. And in fact, I had this set up so that it was doing a...
amplitude knob.
On the bottom of your knob sets.
Thank you. There we go. So this is the compare function. Since it's greater than, if A is greater than B, we have a signal, and otherwise we do not. If I bring B up, I can change that signal level. Now when I bring A up, so as you can see here, B can be any level I want it to be within its range. It doesn't just have to be zero.
There's something very low frequency coming out.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
They don't have a waveform view on the control signals?
I built this thing from scratch. I didn't put an oscilloscope on this one because it's not...
Can you do that though?
Oh, absolutely. And In the more sophisticated screens where you need to see the waveform, I did put oscilloscopes into them.
Basically, your own LED except in...
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's keep moving here. So now the other thing here that we have is called a quantizer. And you can buy quantizer modules. They're really valuable things to have around. You're smiling. You probably played with them.
I'm just enjoying it.
Okay. So the idea of a quantizer is that it's basically this compare function, but a lot more of them. And so what you can say now is I can have a signal that's varying all over the place, and I can create certain regions. And depending on where that signal is within those regions, it will put out a single value rather than a changing value. So
unleash your microphone.
Excuse me?
Unleash your microphone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was underneath.
Hiding down there. Okay, so for example, if I show you this waveform here, this sine wave, it's basically doing this, right? And so if I was to take that sine wave and output it, you would hear a pitch, since I'm going into the pitch of this oscillator, you would hear a pitch that would go, oh. But because I put a quantizer on it, it's going to be changing that constantly moving waveform into several discrete steps. And so when I activate that, let me just do this. Or not. If it likes that, we'll do that. And I did put a pitch control in here. Now you notice it's only putting out two pitches now? The reason for that is that I've kicked the frequency into the upper range of where that quantizer can operate. So now I'm not really getting into all of the zones that it has available. I'm only using the upper ones. If I bring the pitch down now, and if I took the trouble to actually really scale all of this properly, I could get a wider variety. So this is useful for a couple of things. And I can change the step size too. That's just changing how wide those bands are that we're talking about here.
So bring it down more.
So how would we use this? Well, one of the ways we can use it is the way that we just did, so that we can have a continuously varying waveform that puts out individual pitch information. And other ways that we could use this would be that instead of me using that waveform to control pitch, I could be using it to control something else, like the loudness. The loudness could be jumping up and down in discrete steps, or maybe the resonance on a filter, or anything else in the synthesizer that I want to control in discrete steps rather than having them be continuous.
Would a possible example of that be, at least the way a lot of synths are designed, it seems, to control the oscillation in, say, a vibrato? Or not?
Not really, but you are touching on another possibility. You could use...
Let me just say, when I say vibrato, I'm talking about synth definition of vibrato, not necessarily what...
It's the same thing.
Well...
I mean, there's various ways to get vibrato. You can get vibrato by physically raising and lowering the control voltage on the pitch, or you can do it by changing the phase.
Well, the reason I'm hesitant is because they usually don't accommodate the timbral changes.
It depends on how the circuit's implemented. But fundamentally, theoretically, it's the same thing. It just all depends on what kind of waveforms you're using and how much harmonic content is in it. But sorry, I'm mentally drifting here. With MIDI, you have absolute discrete steps of pitch. So you're always going to be playing in tune of whatever tuning you have it set up for. But depending on what kind of interface you're using to bring your pitch control into the system, it might be kind of jumpy. For instance, there is a device called a ribbon controller that you don't see it all that often anymore, but you can still get them. And the idea here is you put your finger on it, and as you move it around, it's going to raise or lower the value of that parameter, usually pitch. Now, if you think back to that old Beach Boys tune, Good Vibrations, that's what they... some people say that was done with a theremin, but I actually saw an interview with Bob Moog where he said that was done with a ribbon controller, and that the ribbon controller was invented specifically at their request, because they bought the synth from him and they said, look, we're guitar players, we're not keyboard players, so can you give us something that we can do that with? And so he did. But that means that you got to know exactly where to put your finger to get a particular pitch. Now, one of the things I could do would be to build up a bunch of quantizer circuits
to cover the whole keyboard range, and as I move my finger up and down, instead of it being a sliding note, I would get a series of discrete pitches that were exactly in tune. So that would be one example of an application for that. And by the way, that tuning could be whatever I tweak the circuit to make it.
Or at least maybe have it the first one you hit be a particular note, and then continuously slides from there.
Yeah, that's not limited. Absolutely. You could set it up so that, say, over on this side, I'm going to get discrete notes, but then once my finger travels over here, it's going to work as a sliding note. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You could do that.
In the example you just gave, was the thinking, well, theremin's complicated. Give me something I can maybe figure out how to play.
That's kind of where it was. We're guitar players. We do this,
so we want to
do that.
Is theremin or something?
Okay. Yeah. So I want to keep moving along here because we're really burning time here. We got a long way to go. The next one is clocked logic. Anybody see my cursor? N?
Hit the letter N. See if that works.
There it is.
Okay, hold on a second. I'm bringing it right down the center. Oh, here we go.
It was in outer space.
Just turning around like this, trying to watch the screen, it's really hard for me to see. Okay, so clock logic. Let's talk about this. In a lot of computer systems and in logic circuits, we have a repeating square wave that's operating at a set speed known as the clock. Sometimes when things happen in the logic circuit, we want them to happen at specific regular intervals. We want to be able to have control over that rather than just happening whenever. And for that, we use clock logic. Now, the two that I want to show you here are, the first one is called sample and hold. I'm using a low frequency oscillator here as a clock. That clock is triggering a sample and hold module. I'll explain what that is in a minute. Goes through this switch, which basically chooses between it and this circuit down here. And then from there it activates a triangle wave. So here's the volume control. We're in the sample and hold. Now, let me explain what this is doing. This wave is a pulse wave. And it's going high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low. And I've messed around with its width to get a particular sound out of it. Typically, when you see sample and holds demonstrated, they like to use sine waves for that, but you can see that all day long, so I thought it'd be kind of interesting to show you what happens when you use a different waveform for it. But that value at that particular moment in time when this is clocked is going to be held inside of this module, and then that value is going to be passed on to the pitch control of the oscillator. So as this waveform is changing, these different values get held, and so you'll hear it in discrete steps. So, hang on a second here. Let me make sure. Yeah, sample and hold. There we go. And amplitude. And I just thought of something I should mention here. What I told you a moment ago was wrong. This is the clock. It's just putting out the pulse to do the triggering and clocking this circuit. This is the LFO, and it can do sine wave, triangle, or pulse. So right now you're listening to a sine. You're listening to a triangle. So there's a sine wave. I'll just flip through them. So every time it samples that value of that wave right in that moment, that sets the pitch. Here's a triangle wave. And here's a pulse.
That's the modulated LFO waveform.
Well, it actually isn't. What's happening here is I'm screwing around with the pulse width. If I made this pulse width...
Go back to a sine, please. Thank you. It's just the tone that's killing me.
Oh, I know, but let me continue with this, okay? Okay.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay, so now I have the pulse width set for an equal amount of on versus an equal amount of off. But as I start to change the width, less wide, I can get this intermittent
V.
Right on my tinnitus. Thank you.
It's that damn tinnitus again.
Yeah.
Love you, babe. So. All right, so now what we're going to do is shut that down and talk about this circuit. So sample and holds can be used for all kinds of things, not just pitch. They can be used for amp, for loudness. They can be used to change filter parameters or whatever you want. And that's the overall thing I want to keep coming back to. All these different ways of messing with the control circuits, they always come back to changing some parameter somewhere in one of the modules. So now for a sequencer, what we have here is, hang on, I got to find the cursor again. All right. So this sequencer module here, it's basically, it's counting through from 1 to 8, and then it comes back and counts through it again, over and over and over again. And every time it receives a clock pulse, it advances to the next step. Now, I'm using this to control pitch, and when I do, it sounds like this. I can change the pitch range. Here's an interesting little trick. What I'm doing here is I'm taking some of these out of range. And once they become out of range, I can limit how many of them I'm hearing, and I can just create a dead band. Another way to do it is to pull it down here all the way out of range. Tangerine Dream in the early days made a whole career out of playing around with these things.
They really need LEDs on those.
Yeah, I know. It's nice to have the LEDs to show you what's active at any given time.
In terms of perceived pitch, those sliders go from what, where to where?
Right now I just have them programmed from 0 to 127 because that's the lowest and highest note in MIDI. And this program is heavily oriented towards the idea that you're going to be interfacing with MIDI here. Especially if you're running it as a VST program, I mean a plugin. Now, let's talk about a couple things here real quick. Back in the earliest days of synthesizers, these sequencers appeared immediately. And some of them were set up with faders or knobs that you could manipulate. But back in those days, there wasn't any way to have any kind of computer memory. So one of the earliest guys who made sequencers, in fact, he may be the first person to ever offer one commercially, a guy named Don Buchla from San Francisco. I had an opportunity to play around with some of his gear a long time ago, and And he had come up with a really interesting little concept. He had cards that were about maybe this big that had an edge connector on it. And then they had places in the traces for you to put resistors that you could solder in place. So you had a master card that had variable resistor pots on it so that you could figure out what all the values were. Then you measured them with an ohm meter to find out what the actual resistance of each one was. You took your card, you got the resistor for that value, you stuck it in there and you soldered it in place. And then that was your memory for your sequence that you had come up with. And when you wanted to play that sequence, you just took the card and you stuck it in a little edge connector and it would play. And if you had a lot of money, you could buy more than one and you could have several cards. And now one of the sequencers could be controlling pitch, another one could be controlling, say, the resonance on a filter, another one could be controlling a voltage-controlled amplifier. Another little trick, if you want to take this to an even higher level of abstraction, is each one of these inputs is a value. That doesn't have to be a knob. It can be another sequencer, or it can be a low-frequency oscillator, or it can be anything you want, so that this thing can organically be changing the values that it's going to be choosing between as it goes through its progression of steps. And this particular one is a real basic one, but in some versions of this, you'll have an up and a down control. So it'll play forwards or it'll play backwards. Now, there is another type of sequencer that I have never seen commercially manufactured. It uses a different kind of a counter. This counter is just counting from 1 to 8. You can get them that'll count from 1 to 10. You can get them that'll count from 1 to 16. And by the way, if you run these things really fast, you have an oscillator. So really, really juice up the speed on that clock. And now what this is doing is these are all the values of a waveform. And you can actually be manipulating the shape of your waveform in real time. Okay, but this other one, I'm going to go to...
Daniel, is this a good time to take a break?
That's an hour later.
Yeah, it's nice.
All right, yeah, let's take a break, and then when we come back, I'll continue on.